Okay, let's get started. Thank you guys for coming here today. We are, if you're not planning to be at the seminar to talk about new headquarters for ASHRAE, you're in the wrong room. So that's what we're going to talk about for the next hour. So my name is Ginger Scoggins. I am a consulting engineer from Raleigh, North Carolina, and I'm also chair of the building ad hoc for ASHRAE, so I'm a volunteer. So and with me on the stage, I have Stanton Stafford, who is managing principal of the Atlanta office of the Integral Group, and partner Greg Walker and Hauser Walker Architecture, who is our architect on the project. So we're going to get into this, but I have a few housekeeping items I got to go through first, right? So please turn off mute your cell phones during the session out of respect for the speakers, that would be us, and other attendees. Photographs, audio recordings are not allowed. There will be a virtual conference that you can review everything after the conference is over. At the end of each presentation, and I'm going to stop that and say that at the end of the entire presentation, there will be a Q&A period. So hold your questions if you can until we finish, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions anybody has. ASHRAE's commercialism policy indicates product names may not be used by speakers or the audience, so keep that in mind. The views of us do not necessarily reflect the position of society. All in this case, we are representing society in terms of the new headquarters. So, and please use the ASHRAE 365 app to complete the speaker session evaluation survey. In the app, go to the 2020 Winter Conference information, log in, and find this session in the schedule. Okay, so let's get started. Take that. So a little bit about this project, right? We set this up as a case study so that ASHRAE members can be engaged and familiar with what's going on with your new headquarters. The existing ASHRAE headquarters, whether you know it or not, is located in Atlanta. It is a 35,000 square foot, two-story building. It was renovated in 2010 to LEED Platinum level. We probably never would have moved except for the fact that we are surrounded now by CHOA, the Children's Hospital of Atlanta. So they moved in, they surrounded our building, and then they made us a really good offer on our building, which we studied and we took. Finally, obviously, or we wouldn't be standing here. So we sold our building to CHOA. We do have a lease back from CHOA until September of this year. So they're allowing us to stay there while we're renovating this new facility that we're going to move into. And then they're going to take over our building, which is on Tully Circle in Atlanta.
How many people have ever been to Tully Circle?
Okay, good. So after a lot of due diligence, we spent several months looking at options for a new headquarters. We studied a lease option, we studied a new build option, and we studied renovation options. And so we looked at many properties, we looked at many lease options, and we looked at many existing buildings. And we finally decided that we walked to this building, which is a 1970s era building in Peachtree Corners, Atlanta. It's a little north from right now where our headquarters is. And we fell in love with the property and we fell in love with the building. It's on 10 acres. It's 66,000 square feet. And I know that sounds a lot larger than we are right now. But the basement level, it will be pretty much a storage space. So we're really utilizing 40 to 45,000 square feet. It was built in the 1970s, as I said, and we purchased this in December of 2018. So our team, I am allowed to have this slide, even though we have a no commercialism policy, so I did check this out. So this is our team that was selected for this project after quite a bit of due diligence and an RFP that was issued for design services. So it is a joint venture with McLennan Design out of California. Seattle, thank you, and Hauser Walker, with Hauser Walker as the lead architect, and with the Integral Group as our PM&E engineer. We have a commissioning agent, which is Epstein Group, and our contractor is Skanska. And we have a project manager, Collins Project Management, that has managed the project for ASHRAE. So what was our goal, right? So we looked at many, many options and discussed this to great degree in terms of what our project story would be. What are we trying to prove? What are we trying to show? And we finally decided that since a predominant amount of existing buildings exist in our environment, right, that are not efficient, I think our story should be that we are taking a 1970s building and we're making it an energy efficient building. So we are trying, we started the whole thing with the intention that it was going to be an affordable solution to an existing building renovation. We'll go through that here in a little bit in terms of some of the challenges that we found when we were going through this process. So our story, project goal, to renovate a 1970s building into a high-cost, high-performing, oh, that was a slip, net zero ready facility in a cost-effective method that could be replicated in the industry. That's our goal. So how did we start? So our ad hoc consists of 6 volunteers, and under our ad hoc, we established a technical advisory subcommittee. I see a few of the members in the room. And the technical advisory subcommittee's first goal was to create our owner project requirements. So we had some of the brightest minds in the industry work on this, and they came up with our goals for our OPR that our design team was going to need to meet. We then circulated this OPR to our teams before they interviewed for the project so that they could see what our goals were for the project. So with our OPR here, these are our mission critical items that we started with the OPR. And then we got into some specifics on our goals, which was we wanted to exceed ASHRAE standard 189.1. We wanted a demand side site energy consumption of less than 21.4 kBTU per square foot per year, which is pretty aggressive, with a stretch goal of getting down to 15 kBTU per square foot per year. We wanted to meet all of the LEED water use efficiency points. We wanted to limit our maximum daytime plug load to 0.4 watts per square foot. We wanted to exceed the acoustical requirements of ASHRAE application handbook. We wanted to deliver outside air at least 1.3 times a standard of 62.1 and use DCV. And also spatial daylighting autonomy for the majority of the occupants so that we would have 55% at all time. And we wanted a resiliency level that we established as we were moving through the project. We also listed mandatory metering requirements for the project that the design team had to meet, as you can see, so we could keep a tally of our energy use for all these different systems. All this was defined in our OPR. We studied different certification programs and determined that after all of these were studied that we were for sure going to be doing ASHRAE Building EQ. And the Building EQ committee has agreed to do that work to get us certified. We're going to do LEED EBOM for existing buildings, and we are going to do two petals for the Living Building Challenge, which are energy.
Net zero.
And energy. Right. Beauty and energy were our pedals for the Living Building Challenge. You know, this determination, a lot of this was made based on cost. As those of you practitioners in the room know, there's efforts involved in all of these certifications. So we were trying to keep our cost to something reasonable that, and then still meet some certification requirements. And then we have our ASHRAE standards that we need to meet. So all of these standards were taken into consideration and were included in our OPR requirements for our design team to meet throughout the project. So a little bit about where we are, right? So we finished design. We've actually broken ground. We don't have final data because we're obviously not through construction, but we have broken ground. So everything you're going to hear today is about our design process. Schedule constraints. If meeting all of our standards wasn't bad enough, we also have pretty tight schedule constraints. We have to be in the building by October of 2020. We're going to get kicked out of our existing building, or we have a penalty that we have to pay CHOA if we're not out. So our goal is not to pay that penalty. So how do we achieve our project goal, right? Obviously, we set our budget. That's our construction budget. It's not our overall budget because we also have the price of the building as well as design costs, soft costs, FF&E. This was our starting construction budget. Our project schedule moving out by October of 2020. And so we set our OPR, we issued an RFP for design services, and these lucky people got the job. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Greg to talk about the architecture.
Thanks. So as Ginger was saying, we came onto the team with Stanton's group, really excited about the challenge of trying to do such an aggressive renovation that could be done as kind of an example for a market rate renovation. So what we were hoping, I think, all together was that we could do this in such a way that we could provide a template for owners that were looking to rehab similar structures to figure out how to most cost effectively get to a net zero and get to kind of a high level of performance. So very quickly, for those of you who don't know the program, I'm just going to say we have 7 departments that make up the administrative side for ASHRAE. There's the conference and meeting areas that are not associated with the training center, but are used nonetheless. So if you come and done committees, you probably use some of those in the existing facilities. A lot of support spaces. So we had about 44,000 square feet of program area, and as you saw, we have about 66,000 square foot building. So a little bit of that is we had some extra slack in the 2 primarily occupied floors, which you see here, and then we had some area for reserve in the basement section. So this is a kind of pretty typical 1970s building. It was cast in place concrete structure, although not a very robust structure, but it is a cast in place concrete structure. And it has precast panels hanging around the perimeter, and then just miles of curtain wall to about 8 feet above the existing floor plate. So pretty wide open once you stripped away all the renovations and got down to the infrastructure itself. So this little 3D diagram will help you see the orange was the stairwells that we inherited. The aqua were 2 of the most weirdly placed elevators that we've ever seen. The red was the existing mechanical chambers, and then the purple was sort of the restroom infrastructure. So the frame, again, was cast in place concrete. We had numerous overhangs on the north and south wings, and then the precast panels you can see here. Now, one of the joys of working with this kind of building is there was very little insulation on the backside, so as you can imagine, this thing scored out really well when we started to do our infrared testing around to see where air leakage was happening. The glazing was insulated, but it was pretty well dated, and it does not have the best films holding up on it. We are right next to a lake, right where you see here. The city of Peachtree Corners was putting in a brand new walking loop, pedestrian loop that was going to encircle the lake. So that was one of the attractions, I think, for this project.
So typical of how we start off most every project, want to get a feel for the environment in which we're going to design the project. We pulled weather data from, my neck of the woods, Greg's neck of the woods. Atlanta weather is characterized by hot, humid summers, pretty temperate shoulder seasons, and cool winters. There is a decent diurnal swing that you can expect in those shoulder seasons. So it kind of informs some of the approaches that we're going to work and that we might want to not consider. Since we're looking at zero energy ready and eventually a zero energy building, we also evaluated the solar insulation of the existing building and the site, both looking at winter and the summer condition. Basically, there's enough sun hitting the site to offset the forecasted energy consumption in the building. So we also took a look at what was possible relative to integrating solar on the building, taking into consideration that there are variables like daylighting that we'll get into in a little bit, that may limit the ability to put solar on the roof. So we looked at a couple different scenarios, realized that, you know, it was possible if we fully covered the roof to hit an EUI of between 15 and 18, which is, you know, closer to the stretch goal. But, you know, what we found through further investigation is, you know, the capacity of the roof to actually handle some of the potential uplift by putting building integrated solar. The roof wasn't going to handle adding too much load to the roof. So also looking at psychrometrics of the Atlanta climate, on paper, you know, there are about 23 to 30% of the hours in any given year that would be conducive to a natural ventilation or at least a mixed mode ventilation strategy. But one thing that people who have been to Atlanta in the spring and the fall have come to know and love is those temperate shoulder seasons are usually characterized by an abundance of pollen. This site, as you'll see here, has a lot of tree canopy, a lot of tree cover,
a lot of pine pollen.
So we quickly kind of realized that, you know, the mixed mode strategy, while it might work from a temperature control point of view, was going to sacrifice indoor air quality. So we kind of moved on from that as a strategy.
So I think one of the things that also kind of drove our overall kind of thinking about the design as the team was the idea that we were trying to embrace some principles of regenerative design. For those of you who don't know, this is basically characterized by you're trying to factor in as many variables as you can up front, both kind of intangible kind of human things as well as the technical data. And then as you're kind of moving down, you're trying to get those to work together as tightly as you can, and said this is tries to lead us to how do you right size everything. So for example, net zero, we all know, right, is just basically in my non-engineer speak, an easy way of saying I need to balance my demand with what I can supply on the site. If I needed to, you know, put a ton of solar on the site because we had a huge demand on the facility, that can be done. We just need to kind of figure out how to do it. We were driven, I think, by the team of how can we reduce as much as we possibly can to drive that down. So the early computations, and we're going to come back to these, really started to suggest that we needed to look at a fairly highly insulated wall, a pretty high insulated roof. We needed to get a pretty good value out of our windows. And then most importantly out of this, we needed to start to look at what was our window to wall ratio, because that was going to drive our ultimate energy demand.
So like Greg said, focus on the passive before implementing the active strategies. So lots of modeling kind of goes hand in hand with developing strategy for a zero energy or a low energy building. And so, you know, pulling all, you know, the results out of the modeling, kind of mapping out, you know, the energy flows, you know, all the flows that would be powered by electricity, you know, the heating, cooling, conduction losses, kind of gave us a framework to kind of understand what we needed to combat in the building as we, you know, sought, you know, the 15 to 21.4 EUI. So we developed kind of an incremental framework that, you know, started at, you know, the CBEX, you know, reference point for climate zone 3A for an office building, which, you know, it's a EUI of 58, and then started to apply different strategies, you know, taking the existing building and applying the ASHRAE 90.1 baseline system. You know, where would that get us? And there's a pretty, you know, fundamental drop in the EUI from 58 down to around 37. And then, you know, we incrementally, you know, applied different strategies to kind of get us to the goals. We'll get into a few of these in more detail in the presentation.
This was our first pass.
Yeah.
I mean, this was the trying to lay out all the different variables that we thought we might run into or have available to us as we got there. So that break-even point, which you see is the middle arrow, was basically what got us below the 21, and what it told us was we needed to combine both a high-performance HVAC system with as much daylighting as we could, frankly, so that we could minimize the lighting usage during there, and then ideally try to capture some natural ventilation. And that ended up being leveled out, as Stanton said, as we went through. So as we looked as the design team at the wind-to-wall ratios, what we had to try to define was how much could we get in terms of daylight autonomy goals, and then how much could we benefit or maximize the thermal efficiency overall. So there was a lot of envelope sensitivity analysis that Stanton's group did. What it told us really quickly was where our break-even points were in terms of what are our values and some of our shade depths and U-values.
Variables as it relates to EUI, yep, to kind of determine the best value, law of diminishing returns points, modeling the actual building against the actual program. So this informed Greg's team on, you know, what strategies to employ for the past development.
So we plugged back in what those optimum ratios were to update our analysis, and then we sort of dove in into what are some of the design opportunities. And one of the things that we figured out was our first baseline design really had us at about 29.3. If we could get the envelope to have the wall EUI, and that was really what was driving us, we had an existing insulation that was within five, our value of five of what we needed overall, so we could modify the existing roof. As I mentioned earlier, the wall was sort of our big issue. So we were looking at how much that, and then we were trying to optimize for how much area did we need. While we were doing that kind of hand in hand, we started to look at what were the constraints. We had these precast panels, which ideally we didn't want to cut. We knew we were not going to come back with a ribbon window, and we were going to have to do wind fills. So we were trying to fundamentally, as we started out, determine, were we going to insulate this over the top on the outside of the building in some manner? So that could mean taking off the precast and putting a whole new envelope on. We ran that out as a cost scenario. Or could we insulate it from the inside? And as we kind of went through, the second thing from the daylight standpoint was, did we need to cut into the existing precast to help raise the windows? I mean, those precast all hit it right around 8 or 9 feet. So we weren't sure we were going to get window or daylight back far enough into the space to get to our daylight autonomy. So that high performance envelope came out to really two options. I guess I'll throw in here real quickly. We did a lot of looking at modeling the existing precast, and the upshot of all this analysis really is the space, physical space between the precast panel and the concrete structure was about 2 feet deep height, but it was about a half inch wide. So there was no way that we could guarantee that we could get enough insulation down into that crack to make an effective thermal break. And every analysis we told us here said, ultimately, if we try to insulate from the inside, no matter what we do, we will never get above an average R value of 10. Whereas if we just go with the simplest 2-inch insulation over the top on the outside, we're going to get to an R value of 24. So that kind of made the decision right there. I mean, we just give up looking at the inside. We did this because the insulating from the inside was definitely cheaper than trying to go over the top. And so, again, you're trying to cost balance this and make a case study we wanted to get there. So where we were at the end of schematic design was we had an approach where we were going to have to go over the top. We weren't totally sure what. We knew at the atrium where that big, beautiful glass barrel vault you saw that, you know, just screams 1970, needed to go away. We needed to do something more efficient with the roof. We brought it way down. And then we were looking at the ways that we could connect the building back to that trailway. So this is kind of where we were at schematics. We had a lot of ambition. Had PV that we were thinking was going to go over the atrium, and we were really getting our wind-to-wall ratios back into something reasonable. So to help drive that, as I said before, I just wanted to show you really quickly, we had a really deep floor plate kind of going side to side. It's almost 100 feet. So part of it for us was how far back can we get the daylight, and then how are we going to make this up otherwise, because we know we're not going to get there. So the existing windows and glass, and I'm just going to flip through literally about 10 of these in 10 seconds. All this told us was we were getting a lot of daylight at the very perimeter, getting nothing in the core. So we did study after study, trying to see what do we do if we add higher windows, if we start to add light well monitors at key places inside the building, if we add a monitor and a raised window, and if we add skylights, and if we do this and keep going on and on and on, what they really told us was by the end, we were going to have to add skylights from above at that top level where most of the staff offices were to be able to meet our daylight autonomy level. And it also told us that ideally we would raise the windows. So we got to our final here, which is we were trying to target 20 to 30% on the east and west, and we were targeting between 30 and 40% on the north and south. At schematic design, this is kind of where we were. We're just a little bit below 30% now in the final design, and we're just a little bit below 40% on the north and south. So again, that lobby, just really quickly, as I mentioned, we had to lower that barrel vault down. ClearStory wasn't really adding enough daylight autonomy. It became also a budget casualty as we kind of went through the process. So we got down to three areas of daylight. 70% with a lot of tall windows and 26 skylights, we got a daylight autonomy of 46%. If we got rid of the skylights and kept the tall windows, and then we landed where we are, which is a combination of keeping the windows at the existing height and adding 18 strategically placed skylights on the upper level. So all these we attenuated to where the open staff office areas were, and that really put us in a good place for the EUI, so it kind of got us down into that sub-20 range that you kind of see right there in the middle.
So remember, we started at that, you know, schematic design point, that, you know, early graph, and then we can, you know, continue to evolve the approach. And the first step, you know, was really diving into the envelope strategies and fine-tuning the daylighting. But then we moved into kind of why I guess, you know, a lot of you are probably here to kind of understand, you know, what happened with the HVAC strategy. Start out, you know, obviously, with the passive that we've discussed. We had lots of discussions with the owner relative to kind of owner goals and responsibilities and around, you know, limiting, you know, plug load, and really had an active dialogue with the ASHRAE staff around what was going to go in the building, how it was going to be used. And then it came down to, you know, utilizing high-efficiency systems to really, you know, drive it down and get us into that 15 to 21 EUI range. We looked at a variety of different systems, you know, hydronic versus all air. Part of the process was right sizing. You know, we were, you know, looking to right size, you know, both from a responsible engineering point of view, but, you know, recognizing that you were reaching out to the community for donations for a lot of this equipment. So we wanted to get, you know, the right size equipment all around. And then, you know, all in all, providing flexible systems, knowing that, you know, the bottom level of the building is potential future expansion space. It's going to be, you know, storage space right now. But systems that can be expanded over time as ASHRAE really grows into the building. So we had pretty exhaustive conversations with the ad hoc and the technical ad hoc around, you know, what systems should we consider for ASHRAE's headquarters? And, you know, we bounced, you know, a myriad of systems off of one another, and it ultimately culminated in two primary systems that we studied that we felt would allow us to meet the EUI targets and acoustics and other variables of the OPR. The first was an all-air strategy, kind of the off-the-shelf, using more off-the-shelf types of equipment, applying those in atypical ways, and centered around thermodynamically zoned heat pump systems, all kind of smaller capacity zoned, you know, by thermal zone, exterior zone, and program type, married with a dedicated outdoor air system to decouple the sensible load from the latent load. We worked through this, the cost of this strategy, you know, it came out, you know, pretty favorably cost-wise. Discussed this at length. Option two, that we developed to a DD level was an all-hydronic system that, again, featured the dedicated outdoor system to decouple the latent from the sensible, But you know, the primary components of the interior conditioning system were radiant panels and high volume low speed fans. So radiant heating and cooling panels for the perimeter zones, cooling only panels for the interior zones. We looked at different hybrids on how to generate the cold water and the warm water. Look at, you know, air-cooled heat pump chillers, all the way into using the existing cooling tower or replacing the cooling tower, going with a water-cooled solution with heat pump chillers. And we even explored using the lake or some of the ground around the building for a geo-exchange component for a water cool system. In the end, we ended up with the radiant system that I'll get into a little bit more. But the cool takeaway here was the thermodynamically zoned heat pumps and the radiant system were within a pretty tight tolerance when we modeled them out against ASHRAE's programs. The radiant system was definitely the more energy efficient approach. It offered some benefits acoustically and from a thermal comfort point of view, but the off-the-shelf solution that we've deployed in other regions actually compared pretty well to that radiant solution. So what we ended up with was a system that deployed an air-cooled heat pump chiller combined with some stage pumping, an air-cooled DOAS system with some enthalpy energy recovery, DX with hot gas reheat, some water source heat pumps to handle some of the lower floors, the storage areas where we thought there could be, because it's a partially below grade basement where there might be humidity concerns. So we wanted to have some ability to dehumidify the basement without having to deliver an abundance of dehumidified ventilation air to an unoccupied space. And then applying the overhead radiant panels with the high-volume, low-speed fans. So the overhead radiant systems, if you're not familiar, it's basically essentially a radiant coil over your head that's kind of fabricated in clouds. So it's basically essentially clouds over different load spaces throughout the space, delivering cool, neutral air, completely decoupled from the radiant systems, to the floor via ducts. Go ahead. And above the panels, there was space to integrate the piping and the ductwork. We chose to go with fabric ductwork, again delivering at a neutral condition. Rigid piping for the exposed areas from an aesthetic point of view, flexible piping and hose in the concealed areas. The ceiling fans throughout, we're using as the first step of thermal comfort control, kicking the fans on low speed first, then to high speed before ever opening the valves for the radiant panels. So there's kind of a staged approach to thermal comfort to squeeze as much energy efficiency as we can out of this system. So just another detail of the flexible hose. Each of the panels contains a multi-pass circuit. You can pipe up the panels in series, quick connects for hoses to help with the construction process. And they're using PEX tubing for the most part. So the high-volume, low-speed fans, again, are there to complement, the radiant system and really expand the ASHRAE 55 thermal comfort zone by moving air throughout the space. Also, because we are delivering the ventilation air at, low velocity through the fabric ducts, it also helped with air mixing and getting the ventilation air down to the occupied zone. So where we ended out, you'll remember this chart from earlier, we're right around an EUI of 18-19 after we modeled out some of kind of the recent additions to the project, which is right in the middle of where we were tasked to be at 21.4 and our stretch goal of 15. So again, looking at PV potential on the roof, we'd mapped it out taking into account the skylights, and basically, if the roof could have handled it, we still would have had to locate some of the solar PV on the site. So basically, this was a study looking at the skylight integration with the PV that made us realize, you know, we'd have to put some on site.
So just real quickly, kind of where we are with the final semifinal design here. A lot of this you've seen before, but we went for a high reflectance exterior wall to kind of help knock some of that away. We are doing ultimately an EPHIS skin with 2.5 inches of insulation over the top of that. That takes care of all our air infiltration. We looked at kind of an insulated metal panel product for a while, and there's a lot of good things that that does. The biggest challenge that we had with that, and I guess I should stop for a second. Y'all saw that aggressive construction schedule thing. There are so many decisions that get driven by what that construction schedule is. That construction schedule is incredibly quick for what we're trying to do here. So the metal panels ultimately fell by the wayside, for example, both because of the cost. They ended up costing more than we thought. But frankly, they ended up failing because we couldn't be guaranteed by the manufacturers
the
that we talked to.
The site's constraints,
yeah,
limited what we could and couldn't do here, where we could locate cranes to
right.
do some of this work. So it's all kind of.
So we had to kind of, you know, step back and say, in some cases like this, here's this, you know, kind of really interesting looking solution, but we've got to go with something a lot more conventional because we're not going to have any chance of getting this done if we don't. So, some quick looks at the interior. I want to save time for questions. It's funny. I realized this morning, I showed you guys all the interior views that don't show all the piping and ducting. One of the things that we are trying to do inside the building is show as much and expose as much of the systems as we can. I think I'm showing you a handful of rooms that...
It's an architect.
No, I'm showing you... I haven't ended up showing you all these rooms where we had to run ACT out to the perimeter of the room to balance the room out for acoustics. That was one of kind of the interesting things with dealing with the radiant system. So there are a lot of lessons we've learned so far. I'm gonna let Ginger kind of go through what from her perspective.
Probably not done learning lessons. Yeah. So, you know, our budget, I think I said at the beginning, was construction budget was $8.5 million. We've gone over that. Surprise, surprise. We ran into a lot of things that that I think we didn't prepare for in the beginning. So, you know, lessons learned there, and also a lot of things that we've hit in the building. So it is, like we said, a 1970s building. So you've got piping that's 40 years old. You've got, you know, all your plumbing is 40 years old. All your fire protection, all of that has to be changed. You know, the electrical switchgear didn't meet code. So, you know, everything you hit in a building other than asbestos, we pretty much hit in this building. So we also didn't take into account the construction market at the moment, which we all know is booming in the Southeast. So there's the budgets came in when the project was bid, and we are over budget. So, but we're hoping to get some of that back as we move on through construction. So, you know, with that, we want to kind of open it up for questions and see what everybody has. Yes. Why? I knew you were going to ask that question. So right now we're a little over $12 million. So we've blown it pretty good. Yeah. But it is. Yeah. So we did actually look at new buildings, and we are still less expensive than we would have been for a new building. Definitely. In the Atlanta market. The Atlanta market really blew us away in terms of the cost that we got in once this thing went out for bid. So. Yes?
Okay.
So I'll address the PV. Yeah. So we're setting that up for a third party because we don't have the budget for PV at the moment. We're net zero ready. We're going to be doing a purchase power agreement RFP here in the next couple months to try to get a third party assistance with that PV.
Yeah, so the PV is all going to go on the site. As we kind of showed you earlier, we got 10 acres. There is a kind of weird easement that bisects the site. But as much as possible, we're going to try to incorporate that as shade canopies for the parking in the places that we can. And then there's some landscape areas where we can put that. To answer your question about the daylighting for the lower levels, so we had to, from a program standpoint, as Stanton mentioned kind of very briefly, part of the northeast corner is tucked into the site, into the ground. That is where we ultimately decided to put as much storage, for example, along one wall so that we don't really need daylight there. We do have the new training room, the large training room up in that area. And then we're actually adding a third training room or medium-sized training room. So we'll now have three medium-sized training rooms. All of those are out on the lake where they get good lake views. So we had a kind of a long set of evaluations of where were we going to put that. Staff is on the west wing, and they're getting as much daylight as any of the other places. So as much as we could, we shoved the non-essential program into the center of the building that didn't need daylight and tried to keep everything that really needed daylight as much out on the perimeter.
Yeah, I want to address the budget a little bit more. So we did make a decision as an ad hoc to go with a more expensive HVAC system. We felt like it was ASHRAE's duty to kind of push the envelope with HVAC, and if you know anything about the Southeast in Atlanta, one thing we found out, right, is that a lot of contractors don't have experience with radiant systems. It's not a system that's used a lot in the Southeast. So, you know, there was, more premium dollars put to that simply for the unknown. If you guys remember a few years back, right, VRF was the same boat. I mean, you even mentioned that, and it was a premium, but, you know, that's become kind of state of the art. So that was a little bit more of what we ran into on the budget. We did decide to go with a more state of the art system than just rooftop package units, and to bite the bullet on that cost for that.
Rafi, to answer your question about water, we looked at a lot of water harvesting strategies when we moved to a non-condenser water system, kind of moved away from the cooling tower. You know, the demand. Big demand went away, and it then became a question of kind of the value add versus budget. So there is no harvesting strategy in place.
Yes, sir.
It's one chiller to produce warm water and cold water. It's simultaneously.
We were not allowed to have access to the lake.
We did explore that.
We did look, but it's its own. The ownership on it's kind of really complicated. So.
It would have made a difference. You know, how much versus the cost? I'm not sure it was something that the project could have ever handled.
Yeah, we were weighing budgets, costs, and I mean budget schedules, and all of that through the entire process. So, yep, yes, sir.
VRF was discussed early on with the technical ad hoc. Yes. Didn't involve the process. You know, that far it was
eliminated. Halfway through, I guess, schematics.
Right.
We looked at lots of different types of systems. So. That's a good question. So our ad hoc assigned dollars per square foot for items that we felt like were reasonable dollars per square foot based on all of our experiences in this industry. One thing we didn't take into account was the amount of envelope work that had to be done on this building as well. To get within ASHRAE 90.1 requirements window-to-wall ratio, I mean, all the windows had to be replaced, all of the roof All the exterior envelope you saw, we had to add. So the leakage, we had what size opening?
I mean, basically the
10 by 12.
Yeah, it's basically a 10 by 12 opening.
So they did we did a building pressurization test, and yeah, they said we had 10 by 12
opening. So
yeah, and this is what you run into in 1970s buildings, right, guys? So this is the purpose of this, is so that you know we're being as honest as we can be. This is what we hit in this project, so.
No, so we did run out an EUI option on the triple glaze, and frankly, if I were to go back to that slide, it didn't get us hardly anything more, and that really has to do with most of our east and west is such a low percentage that we just were not seeing that benefit. I think if this were more of like an all glass building, and Stan and I worked on one downtown where you could make that evaluation. We do have a very high performance dual pane, but the triple pane just wasn't getting us quite enough, I mean, to justify the extra cost.
Atlanta has a pretty good load balance between heating and cooling days, or hours. And during the occupied times of the day, there's just not a huge heating demand to really make triple pane work out that favorably from a cost benefit.
Yeah, I'll hand back there. Sorry. We have. Actually, that's a really good question. So we, Georgia Power has prescriptive and custom rebates, and we are going to get close to $110,000 back in rebates. Those of you that know or don't know, right, we have a capital campaign, and we've raised between donations of equipment and cash, we've raised over $8.5 million for the project through that capital campaign, which is helping to offset some of the overages.
Yeah, so we are on schedule, which is a great question. It's out on the site this week. They have basically demoed out the entire interior. They have put probably 95% of the new framing, wall framing, back in. They're just about to start to cut the skylights, and then come next week they're going to start doing the envelope replacement at the exterior, kind of in stages. Part of it was they did not want to just leave the building, given that we're in winter, they did not want to leave the building totally open for as long as it might take to just rip it all off and then put the envelope back. So they're going to do it in stages, sort of like one facade at a time. So in about a month, that will be dried in, and they'll be ready to do the interior work.
Other questions? Yes, sir.
Great question. I don't know offhand. I don't know it offhand. Yeah.
Right. Good question, but that's a great question. Do you know if you know much about Atlanta, and I don't live there? And I'm glad in terms of traffic that I don't live there. It's probably, 15 minutes north of where our current headquarters is?
20 minutes.
20 minutes on, yeah. So it does make a difference if you're staff and you're going back and forth in terms of Atlanta traffic. So there is the MARTA that goes out, not all the way, but it goes, I guess, I don't know, 10 miles away from, okay.
So, I mean, in practical terms, the current headquarters is closer to Midtown Downtown, and it's right off one of the two major arterial interstates. This is a little bit further north, so there isn't really MARTA service available out there. What is kind of interesting that the city of Peachtree Corners is doing is they've actually installed over the fall a driverless car shuttle service that takes you pretty pretty much from where the main cluster of hotels is, right by the interstate, all the way out through our park, you know, down in a couple other loops, with the goal being that they can try to attract more business up there by having people be able to get to the hotels, at least right off the interstate, fairly straightforwardly, and then they can kind of shuttle them to all the different businesses along that corridor. So it's in place. You don't see it in the aerial shots because it's not quite there yet, but it is a
weird
little system.
Autonomous. Yeah. Autonomous test track, and they call the little thing, they've got a name for the little trolley that takes you through Technology Park, which is where we like the name of it too, right? Technology Park, right? That's where our new headquarters will be. So yeah, they're trying to get pretty advanced in this park.
I've been super tempted just to swerve in front of them once.
I know, see if they stop.
Just to see if that thing will stop, but you know, I'm not sure my insurance company would like that.
Other questions? Yes, sir. Other questions? Going once. All right. Well, thank you guys for attending today. Let me say one more thing. You can follow us and follow this project at this link on this last slide, ASHRAE.org New HQ, and that up-to-date photos are posted pretty much weekly.
Thank you.